So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety.
Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And we have got a great conversation in store. A great topic.
We do.
What a great time for it, because it's a beautiful day.
It is a beautiful day. Cool here for August.
Yeah.
In Tennessee.
And one of the great gifts of sobriety is that I actually have the capacity, and more than that, nowadays, just the instinct of actually experiencing what the day is like.
That's true. You actually wake up and see it, hear it, and know you'll remember it.
Mm-hmm. No, you know, my memory now, when I look back at my years of active addiction, it almost seemed like the world gradually went from color to black and white.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of the great gifts of recovery was it seemed as though the world began to come alive again. The colors began to reappear. I could hear the birds again.
Mm-hmm.
I saw beauty in places that I just hadn't even noticed before.
Right.
Yeah. And I also felt and experienced my own creativity begin to blossom. Did you experience that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did. I remember walking down Main Street and wondering, has that always been there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and yeah. Yeah, it's been here for a while.
Yeah.
This is a Civil War era town, David. It's been here for...
Yeah. And then to find out that that creativity could actually fuel... It wasn't just a byproduct of recovery. It could actually fuel my recovery. That if I would engage in the pursuit of beauty... and in the creation of beautiful things, that actually gave energy to my recovery.
Right. And it goes back to the brain that I harp on all the time,
mm-hmm.
the prefrontal cortex. When we stimulate that, the back of the brain can relax and diminish in its fight or flight.
I was just reading Jay Stringer's new book, Unwanted, this week. That book comes out on the 4th of September. It's one I highly recommend, especially for our Christian listeners.
Mm-hmm.
If their struggle happens to be like mine, primarily a sexual one, Jay Stringer's book, Unwanted, is a must-read. And one of his first recommendations, just a practical recommendation for anybody on the road to recovery, is he said, get a good set of headphones.
Mm. Yeah.
And start listening to good music.
Right.
I do know that we can anesthetize ourselves with music when we're using, but somehow the experience changes. There's a greater depth, a greater texture. It's just so much more satisfying, isn't it?
Oh yeah,
when we're sober,
it is. And I went to a workshop about a month ago, sponsored by one of the treatment centers here in Nashville. Excuse me. And it was on music and the brain,
mm-hmm.
and recovery.
Yeah.
And just how getting people to participate in music stimulates the brain, gets them out of themselves, gets their minds off of the obsession for this period of time, and it has a residual effect.
Yeah, yeah. Well, our guest this week is not a musical guest, but she's very much an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And she has got she's got so much wisdom. What a special person. I'm so grateful that she is going to take some time out of her schedule to talk with us. Hang on, listeners. You're not going to want to miss a minute of Nita Andrews. Well, Nita Andrews, thank you so much for joining us on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
It's a delight.
Oh, when David and I made up the initial dream guest list for the podcast, your name came up very early.
Well, I'm glad.
When I think about positive sobriety, you and your lovely husband, Al, very much come to mind. You accompany a lot of people down this road, don't you?
I do, and I've had the fortunate experience of starting to work in art therapy at a treatment center, so that's added another dimension to my work.
And wow. And tell us a little bit, right at the top, about Lectio Creative.
Okay. Ask that again, but say Creative Lectio.
Creative Lectio. Okay. All right. Tell us right from the top, if you will, a little bit about Creative Lectio.
Creative Lectio is just my unique way to describe an ancient spiritual practice. And, you know, if you know Latin, they call it lexio. Mm-hmm. It means word. Mm-hmm. So they used to do something in monasteries all over the world called Lectio Divina. Mm-hmm. And that would mean you'd sit in a room from 10 to 12 as a monastic, a monk or a nun, and you would read just one passage that's only like three lines long. Mm-hmm. The Lord is my shepherd. The mm-hmm. Lord is my shepherd. Something like that.
Right.
And you would look for the word or the phrase that falls down on your shoulders like rain and shimmers and moves you, and you learn that's what I need for my life today. Mm-hmm. It could be the serenity prayer. God right. grant me the serenity, you know. And so I just was dealing with my own work in poetry and painting and listening to great podcasts and, you know, all mm-hmm. the different things that are available to us now in Music City. We've got lyrics to work with. And I just thought, why not bring that to where you read a poem closely, you read it three times, you ask, what does it have for me? You could read one of the 12-step prayers. What does this have for me today? Just line by line. It's called close reading.
Mm.
So I started leading groups about 9 years ago, and I would just lead people through how to bring this into their life. Because we are, our attention span is now down to 10, 15 seconds. We don't take time with what we read.
Yes.
And it's going to save, I think, our sobriety, actually, if we learn how to take. William Blake said that when he'd had his creative time in the morning, it was the 30 minutes the devil couldn't find him. And that was his language back then.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he's saying, if I come apart, set myself apart, and read or create or do an illustration, he was a fantastic illustrator, that I can't be bothered by my addiction or mm-hmm. by my obsessive compulsive thoughts. I have some freedom yeah. during mm-hmm. that 30 minutes.
Yeah.
The devil can't find me, which I like that.
Yeah.
That's yeah. fantastic.
That's great. You know, Nita, we were talking earlier just a little bit. Part of my work is with recovering people is helping them discover the neurology of joy, or what mm-hmm. we call the neurology of joy. Mm-hmm. And it's really just, you know, not to be heady, but it's waking up that prefrontal cortex where creative thoughts and things can happen again, mm-hmm. and awakening people to the fact that they are actually creative beings, whether they believe they are or not. But as people become aware and awaken in their sobriety, these things sprout up. Can you talk a little bit about how you incorporate this whole concept into the recovering mind, so that joy is experienced, so that that little, like you said earlier, that little green sprig of something can emerge from all the dust and
the ashes, the gravel, that
look
gray,
and
cut your feet. And
that's
all that
right.
stuff. I have to go even further back from what you're asking, and that would be comparing out. I don't know if you guys remember, but when you first go mm-hmm. to your first 12-step meeting, mm. you tend to be the one that compares out.
Sure,
mm-hmm. I'm not as mm-hmm. bad as these blokes.
Yeah, uh-huh. yeah. right. yeah.
These guys really have problems. You compare out, uh-huh. but I think people compare out on the creativity front too, and they mm. say those people are allowed joy. Mm-hmm. I'm not. Those right. people are allowed to invent something. They can go on Shark Week and invent something mm-hmm. that's really cool. Mm-hmm. I don't have a creative bone in my body. I don't have any of that ability. Mm. And sometimes I call those folks shadow artists. They will. They might be in a partnership marriage or living with someone mm-hmm. that is super creative, and they just kind of delegate all that creativity to their mm-hmm. partner mm-hmm. and say, I just want to live in the shadows. Mm-hmm. And they're mad.
Yeah.
They're mad. They don't want that. I mean, mm-hmm. they do want to compare in ultimately on the deepest part of their soul. They want to mm-hmm. compare in and say, I've got the juice too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I get out of my car at the treatment center and I have these, you know, rolling carts of art supplies, they are like first graders on the first day of school, excited wow. to smell the crayons and melt the crayons and turn, use their non-dominant hand and use the mm-hmm. paints. But they're also mad, saying, I have put this on the back burner for so long. Mm. How dare you bring it back up?
Mm.
So the first step is to believe you are creative.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe everyone is.
Mm-hmm.
In the DNA of our souls, we are creative.
Right.
But the first part of this little recovery of joy would be a hungry mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be, and I'll have people say this, in my first life, before the addiction took over,
mm-hmm.
I loved languages. So mm-hmm. I now have this odd new yearning to learn Spanish. Or in my first life, I painted. Or in my teens, I wrote music. Mm-hmm. And they'll herald back to something they mm-hmm. loved.
Yeah.
And it's like, is it completely dead? And I'm like, no. You know, and the hungry mind is these little moments where they'll find themselves shopping in an art store or getting better knives so that they can be a great gourmet chef. Or, mm-hmm. you know, you'll just see mm-hmm. them start having little. Have you seen that in
yes.
your work?
Yeah.
Can you tell a story?
Well, there are people that have had little glimpses where they didn't pick up a guitar or an instrument because it eventually became associated with pain.
Right.
You know, the addiction maybe robbed them of a dream mm-hmm. or they believe that's where that went. And when they can begin to, I have someone in mind that a client that was finally able to come in and say, I picked up my guitar for the first time in years, and all it was for the joy of playing it. It wasn't because I was destined to write the next hit song for so-and-so. It wasn't because I even really could. It was just that I experienced the joy of playing it, and I played for hours.
Mm-hmm.
And when I, like, exactly like you said at the beginning, when I was playing, I wasn't consumed with what I wasn't doing.
Right.
You know,
you just get a break. The flow begins, mm-hmm. and you time stands still. People describe it as they had no idea it was a 3-hour, you mm-hmm. know, hitting the ivories and,
mm-hmm.
you know, just making even the neural pathways of touching the piano or mm-hmm. strumming the guitar. Those are important things to reconnect.
Right. I remember telling someone as a musician that there was a place in me that was reserved for only me and God mm-hmm. when music was happening, whatever that meant. And I don't know if God always liked what I played, but we were there. But there was this part of me that nobody else got to speak into. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little like when Anne Lamott says that, you know, to be a great writer, you have to write as though everyone else you love is dead.
Mm-hmm.
And remember that all those voices in the folding chairs in a circle behind you are heckling you while you write. And you don't have that in that little sanctuary part of your heart. And you could create from that. Mm-hmm. And
I think Teresa of Avila says it's an interior castle.
Mm.
And she just was very aware that the exterior is going to be later on in the process. You might show the song, but mm-hmm. not yet. You're in your interior castle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing. You know, to begin to say, I'm holding this in reserve because it's precious to me and it's set aside.
Right.
But the second step after the hungry mind is a very tenuous moment because you're asked and you're asking yourself to narrow down. It would be like you, Nate, if I said, pick your next book. And you had to say, well, I've got four things that are percolating, and now I have to commit. Mm-hmm. You know, like, have you ever had that? Like, got to narrow the choices. And so I'm one of these multimedia artists that, you know, if you said, I'm demanding that you paint in oil, I'm going to refuse and paint in acrylic because I'm just that bad as a rebel. But narrowing the choices is something that I have to stand and address the empty canvas and say, I choose. And that's a hard thing for somebody coming out of an addiction. Mm-hmm. And then after you narrow your choices, you have this moment of just, do I start the work? The first sentence of a book is the hardest.
Sure.
You know, because you're now taking a stab at what you've got on the inside that you want to bring to the world. Mm-hmm. There's this big debate in creativity about if you carve the most beautiful apple, like you just spent a week carving every little inch of the apple, and then ate the apple, is it art?
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
If no one ever saw it. My belief is we are built to give it away. And so you're the love extended, the other-centeredness of I am going to wrestle through the hungry mind. I'm going to wrestle through choice congestion. I'm going to start and put my mark on the blank canvas or the blank page because I'm ready to give something.
Mm-hmm.
Working can be that flow. It can be, it'll have 30 minutes where you want to cut the painting up with an X-Acto knife. Mm-hmm. Every paragraph will have a sentence that you have to edit away and cut out. Mm-hmm. So there'll be parts of the flow that are delightful, and you've got to always know there'll be parts of the flow where you want to burn the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just terrible.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You'll hit writer's block. You'll doubt yourself. You'll compare. You know, all these things will come up. But after you work, they say that one of the hardest things is to know when to sign a painting. When do you know it's finished?
Mm.
And a lot of painters will go back in the museum and still after hours and still be bringing some paint. They cannot handle it, you know, finish the thing and turn it in.
Yeah.
And then the last part of that creative movement is showing, is saying, okay, now I'm ready for you to read my book or you to see the painting.
And
all of those stages have equilibrium and disequilibrium. They're hard and they're rewarding, both.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's just the creative process. But it's very much like recovery.
Yeah.
Can you see any parallels? You guys help me out.
Oh, man.
What do you think, Nate?
Well, just launching into a creative enterprise itself. You know, the thing about addictive behavior is that it's ritualistic.
Mm-hmm.
And we wake up every day knowing what we're going to do, and we do the same thing over and over. We keep applying the same solutions to the same problems. We keep making the same promises and then the same choices. And in a way, there is some comfort in that familiarity. It's a way to numb myself out from the uncomfortable realities of my real life. There is a sedative quality to that repetitive behavior that... So now I sleepwalk through life. I'm unconscious most of the time. Creativity invites me to wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm going to open myself to do something entirely different.
Mm-hmm.
Inaugurated from an impulse to create.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to come alive in order for that to happen. And I've got to nurture that little sprout when it begins, because I experienced this as a recovering addict in those tenuous first stages of recovery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just want to uproot the thing after the first paragraph because it's not good enough.
Mm-hmm. Let me read a poem that describes everything that you're saying about sleepwalking.
Okay.
Mm. Okay, here we go. It's called From Out the Cave. When you have been at war with yourself for so many years that you have forgotten why. When you have been driving for hours and only gradually begin to realize that you have lost the way. Those repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
When you have cut hastily into the fabric, when you have signed papers in distraction. When it has been centuries since you have watched the sunset or the rain fall, and the clouds drifting overhead pass as flat as anything on a postcard, when in the midst of these everyday nightmares you understand that you could wake up, you could turn and go back to the last thing you remember doing with your whole heart. That passionate kiss, the brilliant drop of love rolling along the tongue of a green leaf. Then you awake, you stumble from your cave, blinking in the sun, and naming every shadow as it slips. So I can take this up apart into three sections in my life, actually. With my, it was a relational kind of love addiction type process. I came out of a family that was very, both alcoholics, and then I had abuse, and a lot of things were going on that led me to be a numbing champion.
Yeah.
I was queen of numb for a long time. But when I read this line about you've cut hastily into the fabric, I would make impulsive decisions hastily. Like, I'm going to go to this school. They weren't necessarily addiction decisions always, but even big decisions.
Sure.
Like what college to go to or what to major in. I had no guidance, so it was kind of a crapshoot as to what I was going to do. But I remember at one point in my recovery, my therapist in a small group setting, a recovery group, had said, there'll be a day that you're going to see, and I just know it's coming. And you know, I was kind of ending up, you know, some of my work with this individual. And I had not heard music, seen birds, seen colors. Mm-hmm. I had, like, been in this cave.
Yes.
You know, where you get acclimated. It's familiar. Your routines are familiar. Your promises are going to be broken. The same old record, broken record.
The temperature never changes.
Yeah. And I just remember I was driving down I-65. I pulled off of I-65, and I saw the sky. And I was like, where has that been? Well, obviously everywhere. I just wasn't able to see.
Sure.
And so that great moment in, like, in those early days of recovery when you start, your senses come back. But everyday nightmares, in the midst of these everyday nightmares, you understand that you can wake up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of you two guys, and I'll probably get weepy, you're holding someone's hand and saying, you're in an everyday nightmare. I have been in an everyday nightmare.
Yeah.
It looks familiar. It looks run of the mill. You could wake up.
Yeah.
What a gift.
Yeah.
To be in that moment to say, you know, the alarm clock's going to wake you up. It's coming.
Mm-hmm.
You could go back to the last thing you remember doing with your whole heart. And that can be a thousand things.
Yeah.
Can it?
I mean, yeah. Yeah. And that seeing color, I remember when I first got sober, crying at a movie and having not experienced that.
As long as
as long as I could remember.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it's a movie, but I'm feeling this, that I'm experiencing this. Is this what it's like to awaken, you know, and creatively not feeling as formulaic and taking risks that I may not have taken in my addiction. Because when you're, the flip side of all this awakening is when you're trying to create within the addiction, you know, it's so.
How does that go?
That's, well, for me, it's just so formulaic because you have to stick to the, you have to stick to the template because you just don't trust anything outside of it. And it's probably not that good anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So stick to the one thing that brought you to the party and do it. And just don't let anybody question it because it's too scary to think outside that little
box. The word I would have for that is phoning it in. Kind of like just phone it in fake it out and just get grit through another day.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not your soul's creativity. It's
exactly.
not your soulish work.
Right,
totally.
Because that's risky. And I would have to be in touch with something and vulnerable and risk presenting that to people. And that would be very scary in my active addiction where I just thought, well, maybe the formula is what people liked, you know, when in fact it's just my fear and my own inability to feel.
And it'd be interesting to know how many people were hungry to have an authentic time with you, you know, real, the kind of man you are today, you know, to have that kind of talk with Dave Hampton, you know.
Yeah.
So the last part of the poem gets me every time because when it says you stumble from your cave, blinking, because it is a shock.
Yes.
to see again. It hurts, actually. It hurts. It's going to be a while until you see the landscape. But you get to name every shadow. That's how this poet is, Joyce Supphen, S-U-T-P-H-E-N. And when she says naming every shadow, that's what creativity is to me.
Yeah.
Because I have the I would say, it's not moral authority. I have the soulish identity now to name something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm naming this chapter.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I'm titling this painting. I'm putting a container for my rage, and I'm writing in my journal about rage. I'm making a black painting for my damn depression, you know,
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah.
You get to now name. You have authorial, if that's what, mm-hmm. I think that's a word, authorial autonomy away from your story.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's the reason to get creative, because uh-huh. you want to rewrite the story.
Mm-hmm.
The new writing,
yes.
The new way to write it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
It makes a ton of sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll tell you, a struggle for me early in recovery was I was aware that the years in which I'd mortgaged everything to my addiction, I was the prince of underachievers, kind of the poster boy for unfulfilled potential. So like a lot of people who come into recovery, I was bankrupt, I was in debt.
Mm-hmm.
And I really felt that, first order was get productive, get efficient, and productivity was measured in dollars and cents, make income, and make amends, and rebuild. And I was just so productivity focused early on. Where creativity feels like, an unearned and undeserved vacation.
A luxury out on the margin.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
okay.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than what really could be the engine for my recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in recovery those early years, I was leaning on those promises where they said, your finances will turn around. How does it go exactly?
Yeah. And, you know, fear of financial insecurity will leave us.
Will leave us. I just like tattoo that on my wrist.
Yeah.
But it did happen that way, that I began to finish things. I began mm-hmm. to see and sell and give and, you know, have some success. But that's so not the point.
No.
Mm-hmm.
It's I have a container now for all my sorrow that
yes.
is leaving me whole instead of leaving me more bankrupt at the end. Mm. I have a container in my writing, in my painting, in my love relationships that contains that much sorrow in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
And the treatment center I work in is all about trauma. So I'm starting to see how art and trauma relate.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of one step ahead of the hounds on learning and being ahead of the game
uh-huh.
for them.
Sure.
But it's fascinating what goes offline in your brain during trauma, and how do you work to bring that part of your brain back in,
mm-hmm.
just the creative side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
yeah. You know?
And since trauma's at the heart of addiction.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
We always talk about the three-legged stool being trauma, shame, and anxiety.
Right.
With addictive behaviors
uh-huh.
and the traumatic the trauma brain
mm-hmm.
And
you used a phrase earlier, David, that the neurology of joy. Can
mm-hmm.
one of you guys unpack that for me?
I'm looking to him. I'm wanting to do it.
Well, it's a phrase that the people that trained me in what I do used a lot, because they believed that the prefrontal cortex, where mm-hmm. all of our personality and executive functions and creativity, the things we love about us that make us exist, becomes diminished as the limbic system and the amygdala are driving addiction. So,
right.
again, not to get geeky mm-hmm. on us
well,
here
we
in the
have
moment.
Well, we have to, because the reptilian brain is calling all the
yeah,
shots.
Yeah, it is. And we don't want to lose sight that there is a real physiology that's an
yeah.
inhibitor to what we're talking about.
Right.
But as we become more... joy, in engaged in things that bring us joy as part of our recovery.
Yeah.
The more the limbic system, the amygdala will cool down.
Okay.
And trust the front of the brain to say, well, okay, I guess you've got this a little bit more. We'll you know, fight or flight will subside a bit. But the neurology of joy, the creative part, the part that brings you joy, or even we say where you go to a group where you're happy to see them and they're happy to see you, and you just receive feeling integrated.
Yeah.
Anything that brings you joy like that,
right,
is going to help diminish the triggers, the desire to use, and heal and the balance of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're engaging in what Nita is talking about with art and poetry and beauty and the things that our thought processes want to put into a creative form that shares it with other people. You know, most of us are communicators, and we don't think of ourselves as, when we're artists, we're calling it communicators.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm an artist, or I'm a writer, I'm a this, but we're all communicators. But I had nothing to communicate when I was
in
active addiction.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I had a lot to say, but I wouldn't call it communication. And so the neurology of joy is where your brain is going to come back, you know, long and short, where your brain's going to come back to life and do and experience the things in a way you were designed to experience them. And it enhances and expedites more of your recovery process.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, and I do think that there is a creative rebellion. I like the way that you described yourself as a rebel.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing to me. I don't know that this is everybody's story, but during my years of active addiction, I was very careful, aside from that addictive behavior, always to stay inside the lines. So I was never even suspected of doing half of what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So there were creative leaps that I never allowed myself to make. Creative possibilities that I never even entertained. There was no way I was going to risk being a heretic.
Mm-hmm.
And so really what I did manage to create was so predictable and pedantic and safe,
mm-hmm.
monochromatic.
Mm-hmm.
Almost legalistically.
Yeah.
You know, your background, but, I remember,
yeah,
had that. Yeah.
But to get some freedom in recovery,
mm-hmm.
In one way, you know, I am staying within safe boundaries, some of my behavior, but I don't live a restricted life, and my creativity can roam in ways,
mm-hmm.
and that rebellious part of me now has a different outlet.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great creative writing coach, long deceased, Brenda Yuland, and she termed that moodling. Moodling.
Oh, wow.
That,
oh, wow.
You could sit on your porch or in your house and you could let your mind, or she even describes it with the neurology part of, if you walk, the right left pattern,
mm-hmm.
of walking is,
mm-hmm.
going to get your limbic system, you know, clarified,
mm-hmm.
right,
mm-hmm.
left. But she says if you moodle, just like, you're safe. You can sit in a room and say, I'm just going to throw out, if I wrote a book on bitterness.
Yeah.
Or some topic. And you can literally just follow any rabbit trail and you don't have to deal with, oh no, there's the abyss of my addiction chasing me down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So imagine how much more you can create when that's in play.
Like, yeah.
You know, I'm not in danger of moodling. I'm not gonna go to porn or gonna go to my drink or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. I wanna read y'all this. Here we go. You're not gonna believe what I found this morning. Sadly enough, while I was driving, but have I clarified that I'm a rebel? So I was looking for the third step prayer because I just love the third step prayer. And I came upon the first step prayer.
Mm.
And I thought, well, before you're even out of the gate, listen to this prayer. God, comma, creative intelligence, universal mind, spirit of nature or spirit of the universe. My name is Nita. Mm. Fill in the blank. And I'm a real alcoholic, and I need your help today. It's from the Big Book, Chapter 3.
Wow.
Wow.
So before you ever even launch into, you know, the second and the third and the four steps and,
mm-hmm.
the amends. And
yeah.
God, creative intelligence, universal mind, spirit of nature, So sometimes what I found at the treatment center is I can have complicated painting projects, and they just need to walk out and find two things that represent healing out in nature. Come back with those items, and then we process what nature gave them. The reason I choose poetry, and I want to give a plug for poetry, it's mobile like nature. It requires attention. You can't read a poem casually. And so it's like that awful term casual sex. You can't have casual sex, actually, if we really understand it.
Right, you can't.
And so there is a part of the brain that's required and a part of your story that comes to a poem because it's 12 lines. And good poems have what's called an envoy line. And an envoy line at the end is an envoy, like if we say we're going to make an envoy from Saudi Arabia to Yemen. It's a message of, will you come with me? Will you change? Will you make a new alliance? So at the end of a good poem, you'll have, you must mend your life. That's the end of one of the Rilke poems. I must mend my life. And a lot of poems point in that direction. And every poem, no matter how ridiculous it looks on the page, E.E. Cummings, every poet has had a relationship with death. And they are saying, telling you something about the other side and coming back from the other side of life and death and what matters. Like I could say there's four mentions of death in the poem I just read. The cave is death. You've been, you know, asleep, that's death. You know, they, if you really look closely and read a poem closely, it's recovery language. It's asking you to come alive in some dead quadrant, some wooden place down in your soul. And so I was a busy mom. I had two little boys. I didn't have an hour to read a novel. I'm the worst book group member you could ever have. I can't finish the novel. I don't have time. But you can say, you know, I'm going to give you, and this is what I do in my classes, I'm going to give you four poems about windows. And they're all going to be these envoy poems that help you look at who are, what are your windows. And we can get somewhere in an hour. We really can. And I'm finding that as well, at, you know, in the treatments facility setting, inpatient, that we can get somewhere in an hour. If the words are deep and the words are good.
Nita, how do you help people give themselves permission to take that first step into creativity, to dare to think a thought, to see a piece of something and realize it hasn't been painted yet, but it's there? The first endeavor into that for people, especially people that aren't used to thinking that way in any capacity, has got to be fear. And it seems to me like they are almost watching themselves do something that's completely unfamiliar. I mean, if you were going to tell me I was going to skydive, I would have an out of body experience right now. I would have to watch myself do it because I can't fathom.
All the steps.
Any reason, A, for jumping out of an airplane, but secondly, that I would be doing it, and thirdly, that I could survive it. And so when you're asking somebody, I know people that have the same fears of creative experience. It's like pushing them out of an airplane. So how do we get them in a place in their heart and mind where they trust you or the process enough to let go of that,
That fear?
Unknown.
I think what I mentioned earlier about comparing out, I think I'm going to give you three things. I would ask them to consider that they compare out unnecessarily. And that's also saying, well, there's no need for another book. All the good books are written. Richard Rohr and, you know, all of the great Claudia Black and Melody, they're all written. I have nothing. And so that's comparing out. So if you go down that road, then you shouldn't probably even get up in the morning, you know. Stop it. I think the second part of that fear equation I got from The Biggest Loser, the old show where they put these people on a fat farm and, yell at them for 4 days, and yeah. 10 days. And this poor guy was on a treadmill, and he was like, I'm going to have the stroke. I'm going to die. You can't push me anymore. You're killing me. This is the end of my road here. I'd rather leave and stay in my my food addiction or whatever. And the guy, you know, hit the stop, the red button on the treadmill, and said, come talk. Come over here and talk, because we'll quit. We can quit. But he said something that I have always used with my art students, which is, he said, fear now has to become management. Fear has to become management now.
Wow.
So what are we going to do to back up here? And let's say you don't ever touch a treadmill again. Mm-hmm. That's cool. I can live with that. But what are we going to manage? Because if you manage nothing, then you don't have a good life. You're not living a full life. So, like, he would break it down. Would you be willing to stand beside the treadmill and lift your legs 10 times? We'll manage that. Would you be willing, I can't do it because my wife, I remember her saying something about strokes. Would you be willing to talk to a doctor with me about the likelihood that you'll have a stroke during our workouts? I'll schedule it. Let's manage that fear. And so he just broke down every fear for the patient in the, in the weight loss program, and they began to manage the fears they could manage. So if you stop comparing out, and if you manage the fear, and now I can't think of my third thing. I'll think of it in a minute. But with folks that have put it aside or said, oh, I know my third one. It comes from what I mentioned in the first step prayer. The DNA in all of us is to be co-creators with our higher power, whatever we name that to be. We have not been given this planet just to desecrate it. We've been given a planet to co-create, leave it better than we found it. And so if I get into that DNA of... A lot of times when I have painter's block, I try to think of the recipient of the painting, and that will get me going. You know, I would hear that someone, like I have a friend graduating tomorrow from getting her in, her master's in counseling, and it was real easy to jump into making a painting for her graduation as I pictured love in the midst of the process. But we think of art as a self-absorbed luxury that is like, you know, self-masturbatory behavior or something.
Exactly.
And some people, you know, maybe have presented it that way on MTV or something, like you just get to voice your opinion and who no love, it doesn't matter who it hurts. Well, I do think it's there. We live in a moral world, and it matters that I love, and it matters that I give my creation to someone. And I'm personally of a faith orientation that I really want to leave a legacy of beautiful things. I have in my studio a two-part thing that my husband said. He's a genius. He said, find the beautiful path. And this was in my recovery days. Nita, find the beautiful path. And I could find the beautiful path. But the second part was, stay on the beautiful path. Damn it.
Gotta love Al.
Stay on the beautiful path. So it's like, you know, 12 by 15, right, next to my easel. Find it, stay on it.
By the way, I do have to say this. I got a first look at really some of the breadth of your work when I went online, I think, to behance.net.
Oh, yeah, you saw the real stuff then,
I was... Were you a fine arts major in college?
No, I was photography and printing.
It is your visual arts stuff. I just was entranced. There were about 10 of them there I wanted to buy. Do you continue to experiment with new media or
always?
Really?
You know, I'm also probably an inventor. I have to admit, I'm an inventor. And so if there's a medium, and I think, well, there's a widget at Home Depot that can spin that better, and I'll get that, you know, part of a chair, and I will tear that apart. And like this morning, I was cutting my, I've got my Band-Aid on, you know, so I will build new things to make my art different. I mean, because we don't want to copy what's already being done. We want to stretch it another level. And so if it's acrylic, then it's going to be the crazy new medium. If it's mm-hmm. spray paint, then it's going to be the best graffiti. I really believe in buying good supplies, too. I think if it's going to go for eternity and my legacy, I'm going to buy the good paint.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
You know, yeah. And that'll...
Yeah.
It makes a big difference.
Yeah.
One time, this is a great story. One time I was making the Stations of the Cross for my church. So you got 14 pieces of art, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I needed Jesus's crown of thorns. And it needed to be weather worthy and everything. So I go to Hobby Lobby. And they have this wire wrapped in, I guess, grapevine or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's small enough, perfect for Jesus's crown. And he only has a crown of thorn on one of my paintings.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to have to buy a $55 garland to snip off an inch.
Mm-hmm.
You did it.
I didn't steal it.
No, that's good.
I thought, I can go get some needle nose choirs. They'll never know. It's for Jesus. This is a Christian company.
Jesus will understand.
And then I thought little tears would come out of Jesus' eyes. So I went up and I paid $55. But that's always reminded me to buy the right stuff.
Yeah.
You know, go wow. ahead. If this is my legacy, you know, buy the right yeah. organ or the right piano. Buy
yeah.
the right
It does
shoes.
Matter.
It does matter. I'm honorable now. Yeah. I'm doing it for honor.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, in the basement of the church in that respect.
Yeah.
I am in the basement of the church. Let me back up on that.
Yeah.
Well, all the good meetings I know are in the basement of the church.
Yeah.
But I'm not a low rent. I'm not a low rent artist.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so, you know.
I remember when I bought a piano a few years ago that there was only 3 inches difference. They were baby grands
uh-huh,
or
yeah.
smaller grand pianos. There was only 3 inches difference in the length of the piano that I was between
mm-hmm.
and thousands of dollars
difference. Uh-huh.
But when you got to the one with the longer length, that manufacturer did some things with a more master level action
mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
really mattered
mm-hmm.
when you play
mm-hmm.
Because it responded differently. It responded beautifully and it didn't have quite the ping that the little, just slightly smaller, but considerably less money piano had.
Mm-hmm.
But I could hear the ping and I could feel the difference and it did matter. And it only required 3 more inches of wall space.
and a couple more bucks.
What the hell? I mean, you're going to have a piano for a while, but it is the thing that it does matter. And if it matters to you, because when I,
what kills me is how much money I spent on my addiction and never thought about it.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
$55 was a tip.
Yeah.
You're hilarious.
Yeah. I'd walk out of a liquor store with $100 worth of booze and not think twice. But I'm going to sweat bullets over whether or not this, you know, over the time and life of a piano that this is going to have a, you know,
lifelong. And probably Lauren will inherit
yeah,
it
you
and
know,
all that.
Give your grandkids and all this stuff. But yeah, it's exactly that. But, you know, when you create, you are sort of witnessing, you're transcending that part of yourself that you kind of leave and look down on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look,
mm-hmm.
not look down on in a, you know, negative way. But you're having this hovering experience,
mm-hmm.
you know, and is that, Nita, the being your own, being a witness to your own voices and to your own, mm-hmm. Inner tapes and things like that they're playing, as you become more of a witness in your own life, do you find that your art gets more honest, that you get more free, you get more flexible? And I don't know, I'm just...
Well, I was doing a radio program podcast thing, and I couldn't bear to write an original poem for it.
Mm-hmm.
And today I still haven't written an original poem. So I still hide.
Mm-hmm.
I still hide significantly
mm-hmm.
behind others' words
because
mm-hmm. it's just my fear. I'm still fighting it. Now, in the painting arena, there's more confidence because I do invent new things. And so I call it standing with your craft.
Mm-hmm.
Just stand with your craft. And if I kind of straighten my spine and I say, humbly I approach this content I don't know that I have to have a metaphor within every painting. Sometimes mm-hmm. beauty is just there for beauty. Mm-hmm. Color is just color. Mm-hmm. A cigar is just a cigar. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
Sometimes it just leave it at that. It's gorgeous because the colors are gorgeous.
Yeah.
But if anyone ever asked me, I think every single painting, if they took me out for coffee and said, what do you think the whole thing means? I could talk an hour. There's never been a painting that I couldn't talk an hour about.
Wow.
Even if it was one solid color, like a mm-hmm. Rothko or something. Mm-hmm. I can talk about what it meant to me.
Yeah.
The crazy thing, and then I'm sure we're running out of time, but I was in art school in Denver after, of course, I chose to go to art school when I was like, I had a 1 month old. <You know? laughs> Get me out of here. I'm going to art school. But I was going down to Denver Institute of Art, and the thing that I learned down there, I can't forget. Let me think of what my story was. Back up.
Okay.
Where was I going?
Aging is a wonderful thing.
What were we talking about?
Well, we're talking about function, or whether something, you could talk an hour about a painting.
Oh, I got it. I got it. Okay. So I was crazy when I had a newborn, and I had a 1 month old, and I decided to take art lessons at the Denver Institute of Art. My little 4'11" art teacher came in, Lee Millman, and she said, do something cubist, which means a lot of hard edges and flat lines and broken planes and things like that. And I thought, that's fun. A lot of masking tape, a lot of lines. Well, I start painting, and it becomes the keys of a piano and the underside of a piano. All right, so I don't know where that's coming from. I don't play piano.
Mm-hmm.
I go home. I live with it about a month or two. And then I realize I hid my whole childhood under a baby grand piano.
Oh wow.
I had books and a lamp plugged in, and I put a sheet over the sides. Mm-hmm. And it was my room when my parents fought.
So
what I was painting was what I was seeing as a 7, 8, 9, when I was just learning to read.
Mm-hmm.
It was what I saw. So all of that's sitting in my spirit.
Yeah.
So another reason to maybe approach art is to say there are archetypes in our spirits that need to have a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And that underside of the piano, when I look at that painting now, every painting I've done has had subliminal meaning.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I just wouldn't spend that kind of time if it didn't have some.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they all have meaning.
Yeah.
And you used a word about hovering. I really think in the Genesis account, when it says that the waters were tumultuous, and water was the most frightening thing to the Hebrews, that there was, I mean, that would be nuclear proliferation on our in our day. It was like the thing you don't go towards. It's too scary. Leviathan is there. Terrible things are there.
Mm-hmm.
So for the writer of Genesis to go in the direction of the hovering to create out of that void. We all get to hover over our stories, pick out what needs to be created out of nothing, and then put it out there.
Yeah.
Just like the Holy Spirit hovering over the ocean. It's a beautiful image for what we're asked to do when we co-create.
It is. I've never thought of it like that in that account, in that way.
Yeah.
Well, I just can't thank you enough, Nita, for
you're so welcome.
Taking some time from your schedule to talk with us. And I'm sure that our subscribers are going to want to replay this conversation, as I am certain I am going to replay this next time with a notebook, because there are a bunch of phrases I want to write down.
And I want the steps.
I had choice congestion, another phrase I absolutely love.
Yeah, I'm using that.
Oh, I do it every time I go to Whole Foods, choice congestion. Well, let me give you a plug for my work.
Okay.
It's called creativelectio.com, where you find... And I think on that page there's a link to my paintings if anyone wanted to see. And you spell Lectio, L-E-C-T-I-O.
Okay.
Yeah.
So creativelectio.com.
Creativelectio.com.
Yes. And there's some beautiful stuff there. I've been looking around.
All right. Well, sadly, I think that's the end of this conversation and this episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. But we'll be back. And make sure to join us again next week. I've got a notebook full of wonderful phrases now. I'm going to be thinking about this conversation, David, for days, I'm sure. How about you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I am going to use her phone number as a poetry hotline. Because I something tells me that she has a poem for every occasion that you might imagine needing.
Yeah.
And I am seriously gonna take advantage of that.
All right. Yeah, I'm working on a poem myself. Let me see. There was a young man from Kentucky. No. All right. Well, let me see. Our guest next week. Who do we have coming up?
We have Nathan Lee next week.
Oh, that's going to be fun.
That is fun. Nathan has some stories and awesome musician, but a guy who has taken sobriety and music into prisons and doing some phenomenal things with people that would have had no opportunity to experience this otherwise.
Yeah. All about service, another big part of positive sobriety. Well, it's been a great conversation, a great time. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Okay, well, listeners, until next week, I'm Nate.
I'm David Hampton.
And we're your pals here on Positive Sobriety. The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.